Across the Pacifica Network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, September 26, 2003, from WBAI in New York and Deepa Fernandez. India tells the United States it's withdrawing its offer to send 17,000 special forces to Iraq. Walmart may be facing the country's largest civil rights class action suit from women employees who claim sexual discrimination. And in the spirit of the 1960s civil rights movement, the 2003 immigrant freedom rides have begun. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A coalition of workers and civil society groups in Bolivia are calling for a national strike to begin on Monday, the latest in a string of popular reactions in Latin America's poorest country. Josh Chaffin reports.
Hundreds of thousands of Bolivians plan to block the roads on Monday, demanding the resignation of President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. Roads in some highland states are blocked already, and clashes with police killed 7 people last week. Two-thirds of Bolivia's 8 million mostly indigenous people live in poverty, and wage rates haven't changed for 2 decades. Indigenous coca farmers say they're fed up with U.S.-backed anti-drug policies that they say are a threat to their traditional way of life. Some Bolivians are also trying to stop natural gas exports to the U.S. and Mexico, demanding that poor Bolivians first be supplied with gas for free. 32 people died in February in protests against increased taxes on wages, and the chances for more bloodshed are high going into next week's planned strike. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News.
The head of Israel's air defense, Commander Dan Halutz, has issued an order against 9 of the 27 pilots still on active duty who said they refused to fly missions that would most certainly hurt civilians in the occupied territories. The Israeli military frequently sends out missions, they say, to kill Palestinian militants in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, often killing and maiming innocent bystanders. Human rights groups condemn the attacks as assassinations. In their statement released on Wednesday, the pilots said, "We, veteran and active pilots, are opposed to carrying out the illegal and immoral attack orders of the sort that Israel carries out in the territories." Additionally, they said, "We are refusing to continue to attack innocent civilians." A committee within the Israeli parliament agreed to meet next week to discuss the letters. The city of Chicago has moved closer to formally opposing the so-called Patriot Act. Tom Robb with WZRD reports.
As John Ashcroft tours the country to build support for the USA Patriot Act, the Chicago City Council's Human Relations Committee held over 2 hours of hearings yesterday on a proposed resolution opposing the Patriot Act and related executive orders. A wide range of witnesses gave testimony and entered statements criticizing the Patriot Act, including Chicago Congressional Representatives Jan Schakowsky, Danny Davis, Rahm Emanuel, Bobby Rush, along with legal experts, religious leaders, librarians, labor leaders, and undocumented immigrants. U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald also appeared before the committee in defense of the Patriot Act. Fitzgerald stated under questioning that of the 7,000 secret FISA warrants sought by the government since the Act's passage, none were denied. The committee voted with one dissenting vote to pass on the resolution for consideration by the full Chicago City Council. From WZRD, this is Tom Robb reporting from City Hall in Chicago for Free Speech Radio News.
Levi's jeans will lay off hundreds of workers as one more symbol of U.S. culture leaves the country. John Anderson explains from the Workers' Independent News Service.
Levi's jeans will no longer be made in America, or North America for that matter. Yesterday, the company announced it will close its 4 remaining factories in the United States and Canada and move all of its production to Asia and Central America. About 2,000 workers will be out of jobs by March. With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm John Anderson for Free Speech Radio News.
Big Blue faced a San Jose judge today over a 1998 case filed by former employees who charge IBM exposed them to cancer-causing toxins. Richard Levitt reports from KPFA.
The group, which includes family members, alleges that IBM knowingly exposed them to cancer-causing chemicals in its semiconductor factories and lied to them about the health risks. It's the first of more than 200 lawsuits filed against IBM from workers in Silicon Valley, New York, and Minnesota. The semiconductor industry and thousands of Americans who have worked in chip plants are watching anxiously. Leslie Beister of the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition says the suit is well-founded.
I think that the workers' claims are justified, that there's certainly a lot of materials that shows that the workers were exposed to a series of chemicals that potentially could be harmful to their health.
IBM contends the case has no merit and is seeking a dismissal. If Santa Clara County Superior Court Judge Robert Baines disagrees, a jury could begin hearing the allegations against Big Blue and its chemical suppliers, including DuPont, Union Carbide, Shell Oil, and Eastman Kodak next month. The lawsuit seeks unspecified damages. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Richard Levitt.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Congress today approved a compromise $368 billion defense bill for next year. The Senate did not oppose the measure, approving it 95-0, a day after the House passed the measure 407-15. This is Republicans and many Democrats say they feel they have no choice but to find a way to pay the president's $87 billion bill for this year's work in rebuilding Iraq and Afghanistan. The White House, meantime, is still pushing for more foreign troops to go to Iraq after Indian Prime Minister Vajpayee yesterday told President Bush that India had reversed its previous commitment to send thousands of troops to Iraq to bolster the U.S. efforts. From New Delhi, our correspondent Vinod K. Jose looks at why, after 5 months of indecision, India finally decided to not send its specially trained 17,000 troops from the insurgency-torn areas of Kashmir to Iraq.
Indian officials have announced it won't send troops to Iraq, even with or without a UN resolution. Over the last 5 months, a strong lobby of Indian businessmen and bureaucrats pushed for an Indian military presence in Iraq. Ranjit Singh was former Indian ambassador in Iraq from 1992 to 99. Why should India send its troops to Iraq?
Because this area is in India's immediate neighborhood. And whatever happens in this region is of very great importance to us. It is strategically important for us. And also economically, it's very important for us. India is a major importer of oil from this region. Take, for example, the increase in the price of oil. For example, if it goes up by $1 per barrel, the cost to India is nearly $600 million extra.
Confederation of Indian Industries, one of India's strongest lobby groups, estimated $500 billion in reconstruction business in Iraq. But a source in India's defense ministry told to Free Speech Radio News that a group of American businessmen who visited India recently met with Indian businessmen and told them there would be limited reconstruction contracts available for Indian investors. Ashutosh Mishra is a scholar in the Institute for Defense Studies and Analysis, a research wing for Indian intelligence agencies and defense ministry. He says without a business incentive, Indian authorities will not be willing to fund sending and maintaining troops in Iraq.
So the question was that we have to spend from our own pocket without a UN mandate, lose our own soldiers, for what? We were not getting any huge business propositions from Iraq.
But political observers say the real reason why Vajpayee turned down American invitation to send troops to Iraq was for his political survival. Indian society is entering a season of street campaigns. The general elections will be held early next year. Any Indian casualty in Iraq would reflect public opinion negatively in their campaigns. Again, research analyst Ashutosh Mishra.
Political reason, especially that of upcoming elections, was a major reason why ultimately they decided to say that we cannot send the troops.
Mishra says the ruling BJP is on a face-saving mission. Critics of the Hindu Right Nationalist Party say the party is taking advantage of the current political climate by justifying the decision not to send troops as in the national interest. A BJP spokesperson after India turned down American invitation.
The party and the government will do everything for the national interest of the country.
But more than any national interest, it is an unhappy Indian business lobby, and the compulsions from domestic politics seem to be the reasons for India backing out from its promise to Armitage. And the end result, President Bush loses another 17,000 troops, which he expected once for what he called Iraqi reconstruction. Sunil Singh, a street vendor in Delhi.
पूरी दुनिया में अपनी चौका चौंध रोशनी फैलाई हुई है। आज इसी के कारण वो अपने दादागिरी दिखाते हुए इराक पर तेल पर कब्जा जमाने के लिए वो रासायनिक और जैविक हथियारों का बहाना लेकर इराक के ऊपर आज निर्दोष जनता को मार रही है। वो रासायनिक और जैविक हथियारों का बहाना लेकर
फ्रॉम न्यू दिल्ली इन इंडिया आई एम विनोद के जोस फॉर फ्री स्पीच रेडियो न्यूज।
Plaintiff's attorneys in a sex discrimination case against Walmart have moved to expand the pool of plaintiffs from the current 6 to a class that includes all women who've worked at Walmart or Sam's Club from December 26, 1998 to the present. That would be approximately 1.6 million women. If the class is certified, the world's largest private employer will be a defendant in the largest civil rights case in US history. Kelly Ramirez has more.
The suit was originally filed in June of 2001 by 6 current and former women workers at Walmart and Sam's Club. The case, called Dukes versus Walmart Stores Incorporated, is before a U.S. district judge in San Francisco. The suit charges that Walmart discriminates against its female employees in making promotions, job assignments, pay decisions and training, and it retaliates against women who complain against such practices. Women fill 78% of the hourly supervisor jobs, but only 12% of the store managers are women. Plaintiff's attorney Brad Seligman hopes that making the Dukes case a huge class action will change the company.
Our goal is to transform Walmart. The experience of hundreds, if not thousands, of individual employment cases filed against Walmart is an individual case doesn't get their attention. It doesn't change anything. Paying even a couple million dollars makes no difference when you're bringing in $250 billion of revenue every year.
David I. Levine is professor of law at Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. He says that there are 4 standards the plaintiffs must meet to gain class status.
One is numerosity, which is that you've got so many people that it's not practicable to join everybody individually. Commonality means that there are questions of law or fact common to the class. Typicality means that you have representatives of the class whose claims are typical. And adequacy is that the representative parties will fairly and adequately represent the interests of the class.
Walmart spokeswoman Christy Gallagher says the company thinks the plaintiffs won't be able to prove typicality.
Walmart's position is that the plaintiffs have a huge burden of proof to meet. They must prove that the allegations of the 6 named plaintiffs represent the experience of more than 1.5 million women, current and former, in more than 3,000 Walmart stores, and that's simply not logical, and we don't think that they can even come close to delivering that proof.
At the class certification hearing, Walmart argued that since its stores have a lot of autonomy and different management styles, separate class actions should be filed against each of its over 3,400 stores. But the plaintiffs commissioned a sociology professor to study Walmart's management culture and practices, and Professor William Bielby of UC Santa Barbara found that Walmart has both a centralized coordination and control hierarchy and a strong organizational culture that establish and reinforce uniformity in personnel policy and practice. In other words, it's the same all over. That's why the plaintiffs are arguing for a single nationwide class. Again, plaintiff's attorney Brad Seligman.
This case is not about the discrimination that some individual store made. It's about the policies that the very highest levels of Walmart adopted with the conscious knowledge that they were going to disadvantage women. The store-by-store approach lets them off the hook. If it's a national policy, you need a national solution. Otherwise, you're not going to be dealing with the problem.
The judge has not yet ruled on the class certification. The lawsuit asks for economic damages, including compensation for lost pay and benefits the women would have received but for discriminatory conduct, as well as punitive damages. For FSRN, I'm Kelly Ramirez in Berkeley, California.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. In the face of significant rollbacks to the federal Clean Air Act by the Bush administration, clean air advocates have identified a town they call Ground Zero in their fight for tougher pollution laws. In Port Arthur, Texas, where oil refineries surround homes and schools, 600 residents have filed a class action lawsuit against a power plant owned and operated by Shell Oil. Residents living along the fence line of Shell facilities around the world traveled to Texas on Wednesday to show solidarity for one community's struggle against the world's largest oil company. Reporter Erica McDonald was in Port Arthur, and she files this report.
Amanda!
Away to!
Amanda!
Away to!
Chanting Down with Shell, members of the Global Shell Fence Alliance gathered outside a neighborhood church in Port Arthur, a small Gulf Coast town of 58,000. From South Africa, Nigeria, the Philippines, Louisiana, California, and Texas, members of shell-affected communities came together to demand the company improve their reporting practices and lower their emissions. Port Arthur resident Hilton Kelly said his hometown was a natural place for Shell neighbors to air their grievances, having recently become the focus of international air quality movements.
Most of the residents here know why a lot of our residents are dying from cancer. And in South Africa and also in Louisiana, where there's huge refineries and chemical plants, these people are showing some of the same problems that we display here. And what we want to demonstrate is that there's a direct correlation between the chemicals that are emitted and the illnesses that people display in these type of communities.
Kelly is one of 600 Port Arthur residents who filed an unprecedented class action lawsuit in June against Shell, alleging the company committed fraud by knowingly withholding information about the chemicals it emits. Though environmentalists have accused companies of underreporting toxic fuel emissions for years, this marks the first time anyone has used the argument as a basis for a fraud claim. Plaintiff's attorney Don Meyerson compared Shell's underreporting to the Environmental Protection Agency's withholding information after the World Trade Center disaster.
EPA came out with a statement that said that there were no harmful effects from the air around Ground Zero. A recent study has come out and indicated that, in fact, the EPA did withhold information about potential health hazards, and that at the time they issued the statement, they did not have sufficient data and analysis to make the statement. So this is basically what we're contending the chemical companies are doing in many instances. They issue these statements, and the people are relying on these statements to their detriment.
Meyerson said in some cases, the company had underreported emissions by as much as 50%. While Shell officials would not comment on the lawsuit, they did respond to arguments that Shell facilities in some countries adhere to higher operating standards than others. Shell spokesperson Tracy McMinn.
In terms of operational standards, be they health, be they safety, or environment, each facility will operate to the same level of standards in each country around the world, and those facilities do report back through to the Shell company in London.
But a study conducted by a South African environmental group revealed lower emissions from Shell plants in Denmark when compared to those in South Africa. A Shell neighbor, Ardiel Sugor from Cape Town, called it a clear example of environmental racism.
These companies operate next to poor communities, poor black communities in South Africa, and we need a strategy that is not only a local strategy but an international strategy to force Shell to clean up all over the world. Just like they are doing a good job in Denmark, they need to be doing a good job in South Africa as well.
Within the next 6 months, delegates from Texas and Louisiana say they'll visit South African communities in solidarity with their struggle against Shell refineries there. A Shell neighbor from South Durban, Desmond Dessau, said global coalitions are the only way to build a lasting clean air movement.
During the apartheid era, we were singing these songs, struggle songs, to challenge the giants of the apartheid government and brought down the apartheid government. So the songs I was singing here were struggle songs to say to Shell, we are still challenging you, we are not going to stop.
Africa. Back home in Port Arthur, the lawsuit moves into its discovery phase this month, though it will be more than a year before Shell neighbors get their day in court. From Port Arthur, Texas, I'm Erica McDonald.
Busloads of immigrant workers and their allies have departed from 10 U.S. cities and are driving to the nation's capital. Yesterday, crowds in New Mexico welcomed two buses from the immigrant workers' Freedom Ride. And as Joe Gardner-Wesley reports, two of the buses were stopped outside of El Paso, Texas today, and border police asked for the ID of all aboard, releasing the buses after everyone refused to comply.
Yeah.
The Albuquerque Children's Troupe Mariachi San Jose serenaded the visiting immigrant workers and hundreds of local residents at St. Francis Xavier Church near downtown Albuquerque. The travelers came from Las Vegas and Los Angeles and are on their way to the nation's capital.
Las cuatro cosas que estamos pidiendo,
Legalización.
The Freedom Riders, as they call themselves, have a core set of demands they want political leaders to open to immigrant laborers. That includes legalization and ways to gain citizenship, labor and civil rights, and the right of divided families to reunify. Claudia Medina heads Enlace Comunitario, an immigrant services and organizing group in Albuquerque.
Another thing that is important locally and nationally is family reunification, because most immigrant families take around 10 to 15 years to get a petition through INS approved. So the immigration policies in terms of family reunification are really not working.
In the 1960s, the Freedom Riders drove buses from the American North to the South to put an end to racial segregation laws. Today, the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride is attempting to recreate that momentum.
So I tell you, together we stick, divided we are stuck. We've been stuck long enough. Let's come together and win this victory. God bless you.
Reverend James Orange was one of the first field staff members Dr. Martin Luther King hired in the days of the Freedom Rides. He was beaten at the Birmingham bus station then. Today, Reverend Orange is traveling with La Caravana por la Libertad and meeting cheers at each stop.
We had to do a lot of struggling to get the rights that we have, and a lot of our rights are being eroded. But for a person to go and work all day long, and just because the immigrant coming from Africa or from Mexico, from wherever they come from, don't discriminate against them. Give them certain rights.
Community groups like churches and unions mobilized hundreds of people to greet the Freedom Riders in Santa Fe and Albuquerque. Those cities have seen a number of legislative victories for immigrants. Both Santa Fe and Albuquerque's city council have passed resolutions declaring them immigrant-friendly cities, and the state legislature has approved issuing driver's licenses to documented immigrants. Freedom Riders like Tommy Gallegos of Orange County, California, now hope to seize the attention of national leaders.
I hope they speed the process up on how they handle the immigration when someone applies for citizenship, that it doesn't take 5 years to become a citizen, and it's not as expensive as it is. You know, on this trip, I've heard people say, you know, they paid people $5,000 to help them get their papers, and then they walk away from them. And, you know, and these families, these guys are working like animals just to make an end meet.
Though crowds greeted the riders warmly in New Mexico, two buses from Los Angeles were detained for 2 hours at a checkpoint outside El Paso earlier today. Riders refused to show IDs to Border Patrol agents, saying the detention was a case of racial profiling. After a flood of phone calls came into Border Patrol offices protesting the detention, the buses were allowed to continue on. More than 1,000 Freedom Riders are currently en route to Washington, D.C. from 10 major U.S. cities. They'll arrive to rally in Washington in the first days of October. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joe Gardner-Wesley.
Have we seen this before?
Free Speech Radio News commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal reporting from his cell on death row.
Sometimes we are so in the thick of something that we cannot see what we're really into. That is especially so in times of war or other national or communal emergencies. We, in times of fear or crisis, often react rather than act with wisdom and hindsight. If we look at how Americans acted after Pearl Harbor against their fellow Americans who happened to have Japanese ancestry by isolating them into cruel concentration camps, we get some idea of how fear contracts the mind. Consider America after 9/11, the hundreds of people in concentration camps who are incommunicado from lawyers, families, anybody, the several dozen who have attempted suicide, hundreds of others, citizens and non-citizens alike, who are held in prisons across the country for months on immigration charges, while judges sigh softly that there's little they can do, and while the Chief Justice quotes nostrums like, "In times of war, the law is silent," while the Constitution is shredded before our eyes, the Fourth Amendment a distant memory, with cops and their cohorts bugging phones, ripping into mail, snooping into computers, and setting up snitch networks all in the name of Patriot Acts. Americans are still gripped by fear, and the government is squeezing. Recently, this commentator read an article which detailed similar historical occurrences, so similar, in fact, that it was breathtaking. The article's author cites the case of a leader, unelected, who stood before the ruins of a destroyed building, who called it a sign from God and a marker of a great epoch in history. The building's destruction was blamed on radicals and terrorists who had roots in the Middle East, who could only be stopped by all-out war. Within weeks of the attack, detention centers sprang up to hold suspected allies of the terrorists. Shortly thereafter, a new law was passed called the Decree on the Protection of People and the State, which, although opposed by civil libertarians and some concerned legislators, was seen as a very patriotic bill by the majority of the people. To please the civil libertarians, it had a 4-year sunset provision in it, in case the national emergency was over by then, and then the suspended rights of the people would be returned, and the nation's cops would be re-restrained. It was such an emergency, in fact, that legislators would later say they hadn't had time to actually read the anti-terrorism bill before they signed it into law. As for the press, it was very patriotic. When the government began arresting its undesirables and its critics, they either ignored it or reported that these people were supporters of terrorism or unpatriotic. Hundreds of people began to be arrested, and then thousands, and then tens of thousands. In his public addresses, the great popular leader spoke of the homeland and his deep religious faith. His soldiers, who came from the poor and the working classes, shared his beliefs, and they wore their faith on their new crisp uniforms with belt buckles that read, "God is with us." The leader urged his unified people to invade other countries and installed new leaders that were friendly. Time magazine hailed this popular new leader as Man of the Year. As some of you have guessed, this is an account of the rise of German Chancellor Adolf Hitler, whose career rose after the firebombing of the Reichstag, or the German Parliament building, on February 27, 1933. This, and the crony capitalism that marked the period, or the backing of big business, ushered in the era of fascism that drenched the world in blood. Think of the U.S. after 9/11. And the similarities, the historical correspondences, must give you pause. This is a lesson from history. Will you learn from it or repeat it? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Cutter Mesta, Simba Russo, with Aaron Glantz. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Josh Chaffin. Our technical production team is Jade Pageant-Seekins, Pauline Bardalone, and Lindsay Benedict. Web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. We also have technical assistance from our intern, Bob Stern. I'm Deepa Fernandez.